You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
It's time for our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party's Simon Court.
Last week, the coalition government released its five-point climate action plan. This follows recent decisions from the government, such as the reversal on the oil and gas exploration ban and the removal of the clean car discount, both of which were met with backlash from many environmental groups. So for our weekly catch-up, I spoke to the ACT Party's Simon Court about this action plan, what it means for the ACT Party, and how it's going to be put into action. We also talked about renewed calls from the party to abolish the Human Rights Commission, something they've been campaigning for years, as well as a new members' bill that would prohibit regional councils from considering climate change in their decisions. So this week, the government released its new five-point climate strategy. In the lead-up to the election, ACT had some differing views to National on its climate policies. So what does the ACT Party think of this five-point action plan?
Well, I'm really proud of the action plan that this government has produced, particularly Pillar 1, which focuses on resilient infrastructure, and Pillar 3, clean energy. Those are two areas that I have a particular interest in terms of my infrastructure and resource management reform undersecretary role. Actually delivering resilient infrastructure and the huge volume of clean energy that we need to support our growth in the future is going to require having an array of funding and financing tools that the public and private sector can draw on, and an enabling resource management system so we can actually build things where we need to and what will be quite sensitive locations, like in coastal areas, for example, or offshore wind in Taranaki. Reforming resource management systems so we can get rid of all of those hurdles that make it so hard to build and cost so much money is going to be really helpful to us achieving our climate goals.
And within the plan, there's a lot of ideas, but not necessarily action on how they're going to be delivered. Specifically, maybe because you talked about points one and points three, those other points, how are those going to be put into action? What are some examples that we could see coming up in the future?
Well, pillar two, for example, the credible markets rely on a well-functioning emissions trading scheme, and that's where businesses and people who produce emissions know what the price that they're going to have to pay is in future, so they can make investment decisions now whether to decarbonise or whether to buy emissions credits from somebody else who is actually taking carbon out of the air, whether that's with trees or carbon capture and storage. So a well-functioning, credible market is really important. And we think that the strategy is heading in the right direction. It's quite different to the previous government's approach to climate change, which had hundreds of actions, and yet it all involved meddling in people's lives or central control of how businesses operated, and didn't really shift the dial at all in terms of reducing emissions.
What about that fifth point, which addresses nature-based solutions?
Well, that's a really interesting opportunity. What we know about our conservation estate, for example, is that while indigenous vegetation grows at a slower rate, say, than exotic pine trees, once you start looking at the whole of New Zealand's ability to store carbon, maybe more slowly, and what is the benefit of actually doing pest control, predator control, fencing on blocks of native bush so that they're not subject to predation, they can flourish, and therefore they can actually store more carbon. There's quite a bit of work that Farmer Conservation is doing, and also the private sector is doing, to understand what that opportunity is. We trust that the private sector and public sector agencies that have responsibilities in this area will just get on with doing the work rather than being having to be told in minute detail what they are and are not allowed to do.
On the same day that this strategy was released, the Ministry of Business, Innovation and Employment published some advice on the decision to reverse the oil and gas ban. And within that, it showed that the impact of reversing the ban will be an additional 51 million tonnes of CO2 equivalent emissions in the atmosphere by 2050. So as a party that's campaigned for the overturn of this ban, how do you respond to this? Is this not negating what was in that five-point strategy?
Definitely not. A lot of people seem to be living in imagination land when it comes to oil and gas. we will continue to rely on oil and gas as a mainstay of our manufacturing sector, as well as liquid fuels and gas, well out beyond 2050, when New Zealand intends to become or to achieve this carbon neutrality. You know, by having a well-functioning market like the emissions trading scheme, businesses that have to use hydrocarbons like oil and gas in their business can pay to reduce those emissions, either through the ETS or through improving their own processes. And you know, I know that's happening around the world right now. The big oil refineries are all introducing more efficient systems because they don't want to be subject to paying carbon taxes, whether it's in Singapore or South Korea. And you know, the manufactured goods that they produce, all the plastics, all the paints, all the resins, all the things that go into phones and cars and everything, they are all going to be subject to carbon pricing in the future. New Zealand's well ahead of the game in that respect, having an emissions trading scheme.
But as the government moves forward with its emissions reduction plan, which it will, how are you going to offset the additional 14.2 million tonnes of emissions created by 2035 as a result of this oil and gas exploration?
Well, it's actually not up to the government to offset emissions. That's what the previous government got totally wrong. It's up to businesses and individuals who generate emissions to either pay for them under the emissions trading scheme, you know, pay the price polluters should pay, that's ACT's philosophy, or otherwise find ways to make their businesses more efficient. The governments are not expected to be the ones reducing emissions, because it's people like you and me and the businesses we buy things from that generate the emissions, and it is individuals like you and I and businesses that are responsible for reducing emissions.
But the government has agreed to things like the Paris Agreement, and they have a responsibility to stick to things like that and encourage businesses and individuals as well. Don't you think that means the government plays a part in this?
Well, certainly with policy settings that allow businesses and individuals to make good decisions, and that's why focusing on credible markets like the emissions trading scheme, making sure that businesses, you know, like if you use a lot of fuel, you use a lot of diesel, you're already paying, you know, somewhere between 11 and 12 cents a litre under the emissions trading scheme for every litre of diesel your truck uses. There's already an incentive there to reduce emissions. And by making it clear that that is the government's primary tool for managing emissions down, then New Zealand businesses can stop waiting for handouts like the previous government was handing out, hundreds of millions of dollars to New Zealand Steel and other companies to replace their old boiler with a new one. I mean, that's what businesses should be doing every day, is investing in new equipment.
So ACT has been pushing for the abolition of the Human Rights Commission for quite some time now, but last week these calls were renewed again, but with coalition partners who have clearly expressed that they don't hold the same views. Why are these calls being renewed now?
Well, there are countless activist groups who will happily tell us how racist the government is for free. And ACT's point is, why should taxpayers have to pay $15 million a year for a taxpayer-funded activist group? The Human Rights Commission is totally obsessed with race and what they call Indigenous rights. It just shows a complete misunderstanding about what human rights are. The clue should be in the name. Our rights and dignity are derived from our shared humanity, not our membership of one race group or another. That's why ACT Party says Human Rights Commission should be abolished. They have no place in a well-functioning democracy in a modern liberal society. If those activists at the Human Rights Commission want to push those views, what they should do is go and get a job with one of those activist NGOs, because we don't need them basically going out on the world stage, trashing New Zealand's reputation and actually failing to uphold human rights here in New Zealand or overseas.
But part of the Commission's aim is to protect people from racial and other sorts of discrimination that many people do face in Aotearoa. So if the ACT Party were to abolish this Commission, how would you ensure that New Zealanders were protected from this discrimination?
Well, the Human Rights Commission is certainly not helping protect people from discrimination. By going overseas and trashing New Zealand's reputation and talking about problems as if we're not here in 2024 with a Waitangi tribunal that provides for settlements for historic grievances and land confiscations. You would assume, based on what the Human Rights Commission has said, that we are 50 or 100 years in the past. We are not. There is nothing that Human Rights Commission does that helps reduce racism or reduce conflict between New Zealanders. In fact, by talking about race all the time and emphasising the membership of one racial group or another as being more important than your individual human dignity, they're actually fostering division and not helping Kiwis. And that's why actually they should be abolished.
But I just wanted to touch on a new members bill that was lodged by ACT MP Mark Cameron this week. Essentially, it's wanting to prohibit regional councils from considering climate change as a factor in their plans. Does this not negate the idea of lowering emissions, especially given this week's 5-point climate action plan?
Well, the idea that you'd put, you'd give councils the right to consider the effects on climate change of property developments, people building infrastructure, you know, somebody wanting to build a distribution warehouse, it's crazy because all of those businesses and developers already have to pay for their emissions under the emissions trading scheme. It is simply not the right tool to use the planning system to manage climate emissions, carbon emissions, when you've already got the emissions trading scheme. What the planning system should be used for is to identify where it's safe and not safe to build, natural hazards, for example, and where we should be building up, say, around transport precincts and town centres, and where we should be reserving land for future infrastructure and future residential development in our major cities. All of the decisions around how we manage down our emissions can be taken looking at the price of carbon on any given day, how exposed your business or your development is to that, and then making rational economic decisions to either reduce your emissions or pay someone else to. That's why Mark Cameron's bill, to stop councils having to consider climate or carbon emissions in development applications, we think makes perfect sense and actually is far more rational than what the previous government did by allowing councils to do this in the first place.
That was the ACT Party's Simon Corr on the government's climate strategy, renewed calls from the party to abolish the Human Rights Commission, and a new members' bill that would prohibit regional councils from considering climate change in their decisions.
That was Simon Corr from the ACT Party.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.